The Sod Show. It'll grow on you. Join gardener Peter Donegan and not-so-green fingers Brian Green on Dublin City FM. Fridays, 3 p.m. The Sod Show. It'll grow on you. The Sod Show, Friday, 3 p.m, Dublin City FM.
103.2 Dublin City FM. It's the Sod Show with Brian Green and Peter Donegan.
How are you, Brian?
I'm good. Happy New Year to you.
Hey, Happy New Year. Yes, this is the first live show of the year 2012.
Yes.
Welcome back. Good to see you again.
On the 20th of January is our first live show, but we have been busy. If you have been listening to the Sod Show over the last few weeks, we've been wild camping. What did you think of it?
Well, we weren't wild camping. I and Una and Aaron Scantlebury and the lads from Millets and Mary Street and Team Gellert were wild camping. You were eating mince pies and putting on a few calories.
I was, but I feel I was there because I sifted through 13 hours of recordings to get 1.5 hours of radio, and parts 1, 2 and 3, if you listen to them in the correct order, you'll get the right experience. They marched up the hill, they camped without tents, and they marched back down again, and I missed it.
Yeah, it was good. Hey, back to gardening matters for the year 2011. I did put a note out on the 2012, my apologies. Still getting used to it. Did put a note out on Facebook asking for your good green and gardening news. There were a couple of very interesting ones came in. One from Simon Kenny, noting that this week he had planted 60 trees for reps, that's the rep scheme, in a field and forest. This is the bit where it gets a little bit contrary, and wondering I am, Simon, indeed. Chestnut, beech, oak, sycamore and ash are planted, staked and secured. Quote unquote, fire them into the ground and hope they will survive. Well, that's one way of doing it.
What's the rep scheme?
It's to do with, I suppose, it's. I wouldn't know too much about it, actually. I have to say it'd be more. I'd have to pick up the Irish Farmers Journal to be exact.
Let's and I see say what exact we can find precise. Out before the end of the show
but,
on the rep scheme.
Yeah, if you want to let us know where you think you know about it, you can send us a link on that. Do so, hashtag it Sod Show on Twitter. You'll get me on facebook.com/Donegan Landscaping, or you can text us in the studio 087-977-1032. I got a very nice note, however, in from Kieran Walsh, and Kieran noted that he was noted and listed for the Irish Times Innovation Awards for Nemos Horticulture. They're based in County Wicklow. They're in the green tech bioinsecticide sector, and under innovation, the Irish Times quote, and I note, the development of Super Nemos, the first broad spectrum bioinsecticide to have been researched and developed in Ireland, that can singularly target a wide range of insects with professionally endorsed efficiency. Well done to a great Irish product, and one we should be very proud of and applauding. Also in there on Green News came in a note from Sheena Vernon, and Sheena is from the GLDA. They have a seminar running on January the 28th at the Botanic Gardens in Dublin, 9 to 4pm, noted as sustainability, is that the question? Do not miss this rare chance to hear real experts, I will not be on that list unfortunately, I'm having tea with my mom, tackling the question of sustainability and what it means for the design of public spaces and gardens. The seminars are aimed at anyone with a general or professional interest in design and the environment. They have two speakers from abroad and their own Dr. Matthew Jebb. Dr. Matthew Jebb, funnily enough, Brian, did the opening speech for the launch of Jane Power's book that I was at last year. We would have interviewed Jane on the show here a couple of times, and we hope to have her back on soon. And well-known broadcaster who argues that an understanding of how questions of sustainability apply to our public and our urban spaces is rooted in biology. Joining him is the horticulturist Philip Askew of the Olympic Delivery Authority, and he's visiting Ireland for the first time. There's a whole host of other speakers, and you can head to GLDA website for more information on that.
Kesht Beog, Peter. Yes. I'm practicing my Irish because we've got TG Carr on the Sod Show next Friday. Kesht Beog, about
yes,
rhubarb.
Yes, you did ask me this on Facebook.
I'm going to ask you here now on air, and I haven't got to the bottom of it. I've been told that rhubarb needs frost in January. Why would something want frost? I thought gardeners and growers feared frost and listened out to weather forecasts. Will there be a touch of frost tonight and kind of stuff? Why would rhubarb benefit from frost, and what's in it? What's it all about?
Oh, God, I'm feeling the cold even as you say it to me. There is a period known as vernalization, and vernalization is the inverted commas scientific term given to a plant that requires a period of frost prior to its awakening. You might remember about 3-4 years ago we almost had no daffodils for Daffodil Day. And similar to what's happened quite recently is we've had a little bit of a mild, I have to say, winter in comparison to last year, definitely so. Whether rhubarb or not requires a period of frost, I don't entirely believe. I hear Monty Don and the others saying that you should force your rhubarb. Well, last year Monty Don was telling me to force my rhubarb. My rhubarb stools were actually at 3-4 inches tall. So what he was saying is correct. One can force rhubarb. At the same token, I choose not to force my rhubarb. I'm a little bit the old Irish, like my dad. I take my rhubarb stool, I plant it into the ground in the back of the garden, and when the foliage and the stems appear, I pick them.
Plant and wait.
And that is all there is to rhubarb. It is one of those resilient, great Irish crops, like an apple tree, that just, you know, the most successful apple trees I've ever seen actually are those that have never been pruned in their life, or they've only been pruned when they get in the way of the washing line. That's the truth of it. And there are master gardeners out there trying to prune apple trees perfectly for year after year after year after year. And sometimes you just need to plant it and leave it.
Peter, we're 6 minutes into the show and we're very rude because we've got a guest in the studio and we haven't introduced them.
We do indeed. Speaking on a slight change from frost to sunnier climates, we have a good friend of mine and good friend of the Sod Show regular listener as well, Mr. Dominic Loughran. Dominic, how are you?
I'm great, Peter. Good afternoon to you.
Dominic,
good afternoon, Brian.
Yeah, your first time meeting Brian. Hey, me and you did 3 seasons in South Africa gardening. We're a long way away from rhubarb stools. Would you be? Have you ever done that with rhubarb stools? Have you ever gone out and forced them or bent over the stems like one might do with daffodils? Or do you do any of that kind of stuff?
Well, in fact, rhubarb's one of the first things that I started with. It was my grandmother that got me into gardening originally. And she used to have me out on the street collecting the manure from the horses out on the street. We'd take it in, we'd have to put it on the rhubarb. But as an old wives' tale, yeah. They used to put a darkened clutch over the rhubarb. And what that does is the rhubarb needs light, so it forces the stem to grow further in order to get to the light.
Uh-huh.
And so if you blacken it out, the rhubarb grows and grows a lot quicker in the darkness, and that gives it a much sweeter taste.
I remember being in Warrenstown College. I was 17 years of age, and one of the jobs I had after study and after work in the fields was carting massive rhubarb stools. And I mean, these are the size of, you know, a good coffee table, and carting them in, 17 years of age. Talk about going in a boy and coming out a man, carting them into old mushroom tunnels just day after day after evening. But equally on the manure thing, I remember growing my first bulb, which was a hyacinth. I bought it for 17 pence, and I think it was 6. And my older brother, Francis, I believe, I'll probably get corrected on this later on this evening, but he told me that manure, inverted commas, was good for fertiliser. And I went around, we obviously lived in an estate on the south side of Dublin, I went around collecting dog doodles and placing it on top of the bulb outside. I was 5, I knew nothing different. Dominic, explain to those, I suppose, at home who have never been there before. I mean, I've done, as I said, the bid. I've been to the Kirsten Bosch Botanic Gardens. I mean, it's a planet, I suppose, for the plants person, that is so far removed from what we have here, which is snowdrops and daffodils. One of the things we were talking about beforehand was when we put together, I think it was the first garden, or was it the last garden? I can't remember. We planted what were about the size of an apple tree that you might buy for a tenner in a bit of a garden centre, or you got from a friend in maybe, I don't know, Tesco's or Lidl's or Aldi's, and they have these 10 euro fruit trees. Well, we were planting them in. I remember Peter from Cape Garden Centre saying to me that these would be, you know, he described the man from Del Monte orange trees. Is that the way it works? How different of a climate? How does it all work?
Well, I think they have a little bit of everything there. They have the perfect amount of daylight, so it's dark almost every day at 8 o'clock and it's bright at 5 o'clock every morning, so they have an awful lot of good sunshine or light for trees to grow. They have a really good warm climate, which helps as well, and they don't have the cold nights that we would have. So it's really a perfect temperatures for plants to grow and the atmosphere for them to grow, the environment for them to grow in.
Can I just put us, we're in Africa, we're in South Africa.
Yeah.
So their southern hemisphere. So their climate is, when we have winter, they have summer. So are they just everything in reverse, or are they, you know, different at our peaks?
Well, they don't have the adjustments and seasons that we would have. So it's basically, if you were in Africa, you could just think of summertime all of the time. In the winter, it gets wet. And that's really, they would have rain there
warm.
In southern Africa. And they could up there. And so, in some of the really mountainous regions, you would certainly have, maybe have a bit of snow. But most people in southern Africa have never seen snow before. So, like, from a plant, it really is, for any gardener at all, it's a tropical paradise, you know. You have all sorts of plants that are growing there. And it really is a haven, I suppose, for gardeners to go down and see plants that we would be buying here in garden centres, maybe for, you know, the top of the range plants you'd be paying maybe 20 or 25 euro for, grown on the side of the road in Africa. So they do have that sort of perfect temperature.
I remember being in Madeira. It came up in conversation quite recently, and the bougainvillea, most good gardeners would know that, Irish gardeners would know that, as an indoor house plant. It has almost like a pink paper, crepe paper kind of a flower feel and look to it. And it was being planted on the roadsides as a motorway plant. And in South Africa, equally, I would have to say there are yuccas that we would give to each other as gifts, and bamboos that we would have as ornaments with red bows tied around them, and they'd be the height of a water bottle. And over there, again, it's during garden centres at 18 foot tall. And I'm going, my God, this is just, it's like land of the giants. It's phenomenal. Dominic, how many years have you been gardening in South Africa, back and forth?
About six years now. And we've done a number of communal gardens, community gardens, school gardens and food gardens. And food gardens is really where a lot of my work is now currently.
Yeah.
It's like the schools, our first garden we did was in an open space in a small township just outside of Cape Town. And it was just a communal area. And it's very difficult to develop a garden in a communal area, because you need not just the infrastructure there, but you need an infrastructure of a human infrastructure. You need a management committee to look after it. Who's going to plant? Who's going to look after it? Who's going to harvest? So we moved very quickly into schools, and we started doing schools, community and food gardens, because the school had the infrastructure or the defence around the school. They had certainly had the land, and then they had the human infrastructure, which is the board of management of the school. So we could work with the board of management of the school in order to put a proper management programme in place. So it was very clear from the word go who was planting, who was looking after, and who was going to benefit from the harvest. And I've certainly seen over the last 4 or 5 years, really, we've reaped the rewards of that structure. And to go back, and the lime trees that you were talking about are huge after just a year, you know. And we've planted orchards down there and food gardens, and they have come on really, really well because that human infrastructure was in place. And so now people are moving into getting their own allotments from our initial communal or community food garden. So they have the experience now of doing working in a communal garden, and they're quite happy now to go off and start their own little allotment and start growing their own food. Because people have to remember, in Africa, lots of children go to school, particularly in these poor township shanty areas, because they get a meal. And that's the reason why they go to school, because they're going to get a meal. So by us coming in, helping to sort of supplement what would be brought in, if you want to put it that way, that this teacher's, the parents and the kids are now growing their own produce. And they're like sponges, you know. Children all over are like sponges. But when they start to see the seedlings coming up, and then suddenly they'll see, look at peppers and tomatoes and lettuce, and then they're eating them as part of their lunch. They're really getting excited about, God, like from quite literally nothing, you get something. And that's, I think, one of the things that draws everybody into horticulture is that just that magical moment, the first plant that you got, that you were able to harvest or enjoy, as you said, a hyacinth yourself, to enjoy when it flowered, you know, and you go, I did this and it was successful for me.
It's fair to say, though, South Africa, when I was there, I found it quite hard to believe that it was a bottomless pit of sand. And it amazes me, I think at one point in time in the school's garden, and I was saying, I have 4 years studying horticulture, I am a horticulturist, And I go across, and all of the rules that I have ever learned and all of the things that I was told were just blown apart because there was a lady with onions and lettuce and she was growing them in nothing but pure sand. And I'm saying, how is this? Like, this lady obviously didn't read the John Innes, you know, compost mixes book when it first came out. It just didn't exist at all, but she was still able to grow them. The second thing that stood out to me was I remember being asked, did we want the large chip bark mulch or the fine? And I remember saying, I want the large. Now, for those who are used to gardening in Ireland, if you buy it in a bag, the large chip is about 2 inches maximum. The large chip in South Africa is a stick or a log about the size of a peat briquette. And I could not believe it. And the whole thing was, we had no access to compost. So you took some bark mulch and you mixed it with the sand to try and give it some kind of a fertile thing. But I mean, this is, a man goes out with a hatchet and just chops off the bark off a tree, and that is the difference between what we have here and what exists over there. So it's a huge learning curve, I think, no matter what level of horticulture or gardening you are.
And I'm going to sound really like I've swatted up on this, but the bark mulch will keep the water that you've put in.
Moisture retention, yes.
It won't evaporate off the sand.
It'll prevent the light from getting through to what we would have in Ireland as soil. In South Africa, it'd be sand. And because it forms that layer in between, it allows the water penetrate down, but it won't allow the sun hit the surface of the soil to evaporate it back out again.
And is it sand to the top, and that you dig this? So is it sand all the way down? Or
it's sand all the way down. That's in South Africa, where it would be sandy. But even in northern South Africa, up in Gauteng, Johannesburg, that region, or on Mpumalanga, up in Lesotho, the Eastern Cape, the soil structure would change, so you would have actual soil there, you know. And like, I'm only back from a project that we did in Uganda, out in the jungle in Uganda, in the middle of nowhere. The soil was perfect, absolutely perfect. And I was way up on the side of a mountain, but it had everything here that we would pay a lot of money for to get the soil structure really good. So when you're looking at taking a piece of soil, you don't want it to form a ball, but you want it to be able to have some structure that it would form some sort of a something in your within your hands, you know. But this had everything, so it had a little bit of sand.
Is that years and years and years of the forest leaves floor, just, you know, the leaves and the foliage and the twigs just falling to the floor, a little bit like I described when we were doing the wild camping up in the Wicklow Mountains? It's just a bed of just pure leaf moulded composty twigs rotten over ages. Is that what it is?
It is, and as everybody will, horticulturists will know, that, you know, leaf mould is a great substance really to have within your soil. So it breaks it up, there's lots of nutrients. Unfortunately, lots of people scoop them up with the garden vac and chuck them in the bin. But leaf mould's a really, really good fertiliser. So anywhere where there would have been forestation, you would generally find that the soil actually would be good. Even the fact that the trees would have been taking a certain amount of nutrients out themselves. But, you know, over them hundreds of years, whatever, the soil is absolutely, it's fantastic. And we planted down, the last garden we're in, over 1,000 pineapples in one of the gardens.
I would love to see that.
It's absolutely, it was really, really great to do, you know. But the soil was so good that the people from the Department of Agriculture, that came out to sort of help us with the spacings and for the garden, they were saying, like, the soil here is perfect. If we could bag this and sell it, we'd be doing very well, you know.
Wow.
We're going to go to Song of the Week before we come back to our studio guest. And because that rhubarb needs light, this is the pun. We always have to have a kind of a link to our song. This is Becca Stevens, and There Is a Light That Never Goes Out. There's people and they're young and alive.
Wonderful voice of Becca Stevens with the Smiths cover "There Is a Light That Never Goes Out." It was funny during the while the song was on, myself and Dominic and Brian were talking, and Dominic actually asked me, had I ever grown pineapples? I had tried. I always did that thing at home, Dominic, where you cut the top off the carrot and you put it in a saucer of water and you let it sprout again. But I do remember my grandmother growing a lemon tree from a pip, which, again, I think it breaks all those horticultural rules, but one of those that I suppose is kind of inspiring a little bit when somebody says, or the book says, that you can't or one shouldn't or should not, shan't, maybe is the appropriate term to use, and one actually does and one gets to do it. It's absolutely brilliant. Hey, on the other side of all of this, amawele.org, is that the correct pronunciation?
Yeah, amawele, it means twins in Xhosa.
And to give people a bit of an insight into this, the first 3 years when I did the gardens in South Africa alongside yourself, we would have done that via the Nile Melon Township Trust. This is a slightly or entirely different thing, and this is your second trip, is it, with Amawele?
No, this is going to be our first trip with Amawele. I'd done a separate trip to Uganda last year for another charity, you know.
Yeah.
I suppose maybe you get known within the sector for being able to recruit people and take them out to do horticultural projects, which is always a very nice compliment. But Amawele is a small organisation based here in Ireland, and they twin off schools in South Africa with schools in Ireland, and they do projects together, and a lot of the projects they're doing now are all horticultural projects. So I'm right in the middle of that, and as I say, we've expanded into food gardens and they become very important to us. But it's great the way that the schools in Ireland can start their carrots, the school in South Africa will do the same thing, and then they'll match off the
Is that how that works?
That's how they're doing, yeah, that's what we're doing. So they do a project together, and a lot of them are now food based, and it's really, really good just to see the results from Ireland and the results from South Africa.
Let me break this down. Theoretically, the twinning of, let's say, Dan's fifth class in Balbriggan, who I was teaching there some time ago, they build a garden, not obviously the kids travel across and do it, but they build a garden in their school, mm-hmm. and you build one in Picketown in South Africa, and the two schools stay in touch, obviously via the internet.
Yes.
Is that how it works?
They use Facebook, they use Ping. We organise Skype calls because we've people, we've an education officer in Ireland, and she travels around all the schools in Ireland, and we've an education officer in South Africa, and she travels around the schools there. So they'll do a Skype call between the two schools.
That is phenomenal.
Which is great, and the projects are great. So the kids in South Africa will get their project, put it together, send it back to Ireland. The Irish school sends their project to South Africa, and then they'll talk about it on Skype. And they use Facebook and all the other sort of mediums that are there, email, which is really super, because a lot of the schools here and in South Africa, that twinning aspect really adds an awful lot to the schools, you know.
And go ahead, sorry.
What we were wanting to do next, and I suppose our reason in a way for coming in was that to get some of the teachers to come out, go out to the schools and other individuals who could help with food gardens there. So we're taking a group of volunteers out in November, hopefully 30 volunteers who'll have some sort of horticultural experience. So it really is a call to anyone in the sector. I think over the last 6 years I've taken out 300 people out of the horticultural sector in Ireland, which has been terrific. And I think, like yourself, you've been there 3 times, that the experience was exceptional.
It, from a horticultural perspective, and I mean horticulturist, just the learning, the knowledge, just the far side gallery of seeing how it all happens as versus reading about it. I mean, I remember having a disagreement with another gardener in Kirsten Bush Botanical Gardens, and it was just two gardeners having a chat, but I was in a pair of jeans and a t-shirt, and he was in the Man from Del Monte kind of cap. Shortly, because we're on the run into the tail end of the sideshow, thank God, says some. If people want to get in touch, Dominic, how do they go about it? How do they get in touch with you?
Well, they get the website is amawele.org.
Spell that.
Amawele.
Yep.
Or if they Google me, I'm sure they'll find lots and lots of links.
Yeah, I'll put the link up on
that we've had.
I'll put the link up on blog.donaganlandscaping.com. I'll also throw it up on facebook.com/Donagan Landscaping. And if you do wish to get in touch with us, you can just hashtag any tweet sideshow and we'll pick it up that way.
And in a nutshell, you're looking for people to take part in this and they'll fundraise to get their ticket to go kind of thing.
They do indeed, yeah. It's a wonderful experience. I have to say, everybody should go to Africa at least once in their lifetime.
Fully agree with that.
Many people would, like Peter would say, is that they had to be persuaded to go, but it was the best experience they've ever had.
Yeah. Dominic's looking for $3,000 as a by the way to go and do this. That's flights, I won't say accommodation, because you'll be doing an equivalent of wild camping it. So there's no hotels,
it will
no
be
fancy
basic
dance.
Enough, yeah.
Yeah, very basic. But if you do want to get in touch, as I said, hashtag it Sideshow, I'll pop you across all of the details. But I would highly recommend it.
Thank
you, Dominic, it's been a pleasure having you in studio. Brian, good to see
you
again.
Thank you.
And Happy New Year to you.
And thanks to you at home. My apologies for tuning in and listening. Find us on iTunes, etc. And we'll talk to you next week.
Yes, indeed. Next week's show we have...
Oh, Sheila from TG Cahir.
Yes.
The gardening programme. Yes, returning to our screens. I'll have more details of that again up on the blog. But do,
next Friday at 3. Take care.
Bye-bye.